This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Are you asked to keep any war crimes you might see secret?
You see something that's so wrong.
Light them all up.
It's very hard for a lower level soldier to turn on his officers and say there was a war crime here.
The whole concept of whistleblower laws are you cannot get into trouble for reporting about illegal or improper activity.
I think we have to be clear that the cables were not top secret documents.
It's an absurd charge to giving aid and comfort to the enemy.
If you saw incredible things,
awful things, things that belonged in the public domain,
and not on some server
stored in a dark room in Washington, D.C.,
what would you do?
What would you do?
What would you do?
What would you do?
I was Bradley Manning.
I am Bradley Manning.
I am Bradley Manning.
I am Bradley Manning.
I am Bradley Manning.
Bradley Manning.
Bradley Manning.
Bradley Manning.
I hope that we are all
Bradley Manning.
And now what do we do about this?
If you know nothing about Bradley Manning, you should find out. And then you should help me bust him out of jail.
Welcome to The Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yemen. And you can watch that video online at iambradleymanning.org. That is a PSA that folks have put together. You'll recognize some of the people in that video who are asking for Bradley Manning's charges to be dropped and for him to be freed after his 3 years of incarceration. His court-martial trial has actually just begun this month. So let's have an update on the Bradley Manning court-martial trial. Bradley Manning, of course, a 25-year-old Army intelligence analyst facing decades in prison or the death penalty for allegedly leaking a video to the website WikiLeaks of a U.S. helicopter shooting attack that wounded two children and killed at least 11 Iraqi citizens. The video clearly depicts the U.S. soldiers aiming their gun sight targets on people trying to crawl away and being targeted and shot as if in a video game. The soldiers can be clearly heard talking about murdering the civilians in derogatory words. In addition to this collateral murder video, Private First Class Manning is suspected of leaking the Afghan war diaries, tens of thousands of battlefield reports that explicitly describe civilian deaths and cover-ups, corrupt officials, collusion with warlords, and a failing U.S.-NATO war effort. Bradley Manning has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. There is no evidence that anyone died as a result of the leaked information, yet Bradley faces life in prison or possibly death. The greatest charge against him is that of aiding the enemy, a capital offense. As the public who benefited from this information, does that make us the enemy? What price will future whistleblowers pay? We're going to talk about that on today's program, in addition to Edward Snowden, the most recent whistleblower, and his Guardian interview. We'll hear that. And we'll also hear an interview that I did last month with a local manufacturer of hand-blown lighting glass. So it's a little bit of a compare and contrast. So I've put that in the second part of the program. Brian Faraday of Schoolhouse Electric. Norman Solomon wrote an article published June 5th on Common Dreams titled Bradley Manning is Guilty of Aiding the Enemy If the Enemy is Democracy. Of all the charges against Bradley Manning, Solomon says, the most pernicious and revealing is aiding the enemy. A blogger at The New Yorker, Amy Davidson, raised a pair of big questions that now loom over the courtroom at Fort Meade and over the entire country. She writes, would it aid the enemy, for example, to expose war crimes committed by American forces or lies told by the American government? And in that case, who is aiding the enemy, the whistleblower or the perpetrators themselves? When the deceptive operation of the warfare state can't stand the light of day, Solomon says, truth tellers are a constant hazard and culpability must stay turned on its head. Solomon writes, candid answers to such questions are not only inadmissible in the military courtroom where Bradley Manning is on trial, candor is also excluded from the national venues where the warfare state preens itself as virtue's paragon. On June 12th, several more government witnesses testified about Bradley Manning's online activity, access to various software programs, and what the Apache video revealed. Court is in recess until Monday, June 17th. Bradley's defense has repeatedly demonstrated errors and false accusations on the part of the government against Bradley Manning. Lack of evidence on Manning's personal laptop have demonstrated that many of the government's accusations are completely manufactured with no evidence to back them up. While the government spent significant time proving Bradley's installation of a Linux operating system, which allowed him to access the password SAM file, the defense quickly showed on cross-examination that he actually never accessed the system file and therefore couldn't have accessed secret passwords. You can learn more at bradleymanning.org. Like many of you, I have been absorbing the information about the latest leaks from the NSA PRISM program. It's hard to believe what your government tells you when you find out they're secretly spying on you, right? Former CIA contractor Edward Snowden leaked a PowerPoint presentation proving that the NSA had been spying on U.S. citizens' internet activities for at least 6 years. NSA slides explain the PRISM data collection program, published June 6, 2013 in the Washington Post. Through a top-secret program authorized by federal judges working under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, the U.S. intelligence community can gain access to the servers of 9 internet companies for a wide range of digital data. Documents describing the previously undisclosed program obtained by the Washington Post show the breadth of U.S. electronic surveillance capabilities in the wake of a widely publicized controversy over warrantless wiretapping of U.S. domestic telephone communications in 2005. These slides, annotated by the Washington Post, represent a selection from the overall document. Certain portions are redacted. You can go to the Washington Post and have a look at what there is of that slideshow yourself. Edward Joseph Snowden was a technical contractor for the NSA before disclosing details of classified NSA mass surveillance programs to the press. He is currently in Hong Kong, where he says, as we'll hear in his own words later in the program, he has the best chance of being treated fairly and not ending up being another Bradley Manning, although he's pessimistic in his words. The U.S. government is trying to paint him as a possible defector to China, a charge Snowden states is ludicrous. Snowden shared classified material on top-secret NSA programs, including the PRISM surveillance program, with The Guardian and The Washington Post, both of whom published their first exposés last week. Snowden says his disclosure of PRISM and FISA orders related to NSA data capture efforts was an effort to expose what he believes is excessive government surveillance of the American people. Daniel Ellsberg is famous for leaking the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Ellsberg, 82, was the hero at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley Tuesday night, but the man who made history by leaking the Pentagon Papers, which showed how the U.S. government lied about the Vietnam War, had even higher praise for Edward Snowden, who leaked the information about the U.S. secret surveillance program. Ellsberg says, "I don't ever think there's been a more significant disclosure than what he's made. It gives us the chance that I thought might never come to change the situation of total surveillance by the government." When interviewed recently in the Huffington Post, Daniel Ellsberg had this to say about Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden.
"People are not in the military are not supposed to be obey an illegal order. And in most cases, of course, they give the benefit of the doubt to their boss or to the government, and they're supposed to. But some orders are blatantly illegal, such as the orders that Bradley Manning exposed not to investigate clear evidence of torture by our Iraqi allies, not to hand over people to be tortured. And that was a blatantly illegal order, but one person chose to disobey it, and that was Bradley Manning. In the case of Snowden, I would say the idea of listening in, and let me come back to that, but getting what they call the metadata on who is being called, who at all the social network connections are, the person indulging in any kind of conversation. To do that essentially for all Americans who have an electronic device is blatantly unconstitutional. When the president says it's legal, he's referring to an obscure part of the Patriot Act that most congressmen passed without even reading it. But in fact, Congress can't make that constitutional. Congress can't rescind the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, granting our privacy and calling for warrants, nor can the president. So the constitutionality of that very much remains to be determined by the Supreme Court. I don't determine it, but if I read it, if Snowden had showed that to me, I would have said that is clearly a getting rid of one of the main rights that we fought for in the revolution, in fact, to be free of warrants, broad warrants like this by the British, and this is clearly unconstitutional, so, and I would have advised him to put it out."
Journalist Glenn Greenwald interviewed NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Glenn Greenwald is an award-winning journalist, former constitutional litigator, and featured columnist for The Guardian. He brought to light the PRISM program and a separate program that trawls through U.S. phone records and said the public has a right to know and openly debate what the government is doing. In the interview, when asked why he did what he did, why he decided to become a whistleblower, Snowden replied, "The NSA has built an infrastructure that allows it to intercept almost everything. With this capability, the vast majority of human communications are automatically ingested without any targeting. If I wanted to see your emails or your wife's phone, all I have to do is use intercepts. I can get your emails, passwords, phone records, and credit cards." He said, "I don't want to live in a society that does these sorts of things. I do not want to live in a world where everything I do and say is recorded. That is not something I'm willing to support or live under." But we're going to listen now to Edward Snowden, in his own words, talking to Glenn Greenwald and Ewan McCaskill.
My name is Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
What are some of the positions that you held previously within the intelligence community?
I've been a systems engineer, systems administrator, senior advisor for the Central Intelligence Agency, solutions consultant, and a telecommunications information systems officer.
One of the things people are going to be most interested in trying to understand who you are and what you're thinking is, there came some point in time when you crossed this line of thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. Walk people through that decision-making process.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing, but over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis. And you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up, and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. Until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes, on the grounds of sort of a self-certification, that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends. So while they may be intending to target someone associated with a foreign government or someone that they suspect of terrorism, they're collecting your communications to do so. Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything, but I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Have you given thought to what it is that the U.S. government's response to your conduct is in terms of what they might say about you, how they might try to depict you, what they might try to do to you?
Yeah, I could be, you know, rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of their third-party partners. They work closely with a number of other nations. Or, you know, they could pay off the triads or, you know, any of their agents or assets. We've got a CIA station just up the road in the consulate here in Hong Kong. And I'm sure they're going to be very busy for the next week. And that's a fear I'll live under for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature. You can get up every day, you can go to work, you can collect your large paycheck for relatively little work against the public interest and go to sleep at night after watching your shows. But if you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk. And it doesn't matter what the outcome is, so long as the public gets to make their own decisions about how that's applied.
Why should people care about surveillance?
Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
We are currently sitting in a room in Hong Kong, which is where we are because you've traveled here. Talk a little bit about why it is that you came here, and specifically there are going to be people who will speculate that what you really intend to do is to defect to the country that many see as the number one rival of the United States, which is China, and that what you're really doing is essentially seeking to aid an enemy of the United States with which you intend to seek asylum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's a couple assertions in those arguments that are sort of embedded in the questioning of the choice of Hong Kong. The first is that China is an enemy of the United States. It's not. I mean, there are conflicts between the United States government and the Chinese PRC government, but the peoples inherently, you know, we don't care. We trade with each other freely. You know, we're not at war. We're not in armed conflict, and we're not trying to be. We're the largest trading partners out there for each other. Additionally, Hong Kong has a strong tradition of free speech. People think, oh, China, great firewall. Mainland China does have significant restrictions on free speech, but the people of Hong Kong have a long tradition of protesting in the streets, of making their views known. The internet is not filtered here, no more so than any other Western government. And I believe that the Hong Kong government is actually independent in relation to a lot of other leading Western governments.
If your motive had been to harm the United States and help its enemies, or if your motive had been personal material gain, were there things that you could have done with these documents to advance those goals that you didn't end up doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody in the positions of access with the technical capabilities that I had could, you know, suck out secrets, pass them on the open market to Russia. You know, they always have an open door, as we do. I had access to, you know, the full rosters of everyone working at the NSA, the entire intelligence community, and undercover assets all around the world, the locations of every station we have, what their missions are, and so forth. If I had just wanted to harm the U.S., you know, that you could shut down the surveillance system in an afternoon, but that's not my intention. And I think for anyone making that argument, they need to think, if they were in my position, and you know, you live a privileged life, you're living in Hawaii in paradise and making a ton of money, what would it take to make you leave everything behind? The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only going to get worse until eventually there will be a time where policies will change, because the only thing that restricts the activities of the surveillance state are policy. Even our agreements with other sovereign governments, we consider that to be a stipulation of policy rather than a stipulation of law. And because of that, a new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority, we need more power, and there will be nothing the people can do at that point to oppose it, and it'll be turnkey tyranny.
Listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, interview with Brian Faherty of Schoolhouse Electric.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. I had the good fortune this year to attend TEDx in Portland and heard many wonderful TED Talks, one by Brian Faherty, owner of Schoolhouse Electric. He spoke to the delicate balance between our digital and analog lives. We met in the KBOO studios last month to talk about the new local manufacturing economy, manufacturing handmade or hand-blown glass lighting fixtures from antique molds, and the new maker movement, how manufacturing businesses can support small manufacturers, craftspeople, and what's happening with that locally. Tune in now as we talk about consumer culture, new and unorthodox business models, unplugging, and much more. I'm Rabia Yeaman for The Digital Divide. Today I'm speaking with Brian Faherty, founder, owner, and creative director of Schoolhouse Electric, located in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Rabia.
You also have a shop in Tribeca, New York.
We do, yeah, on Vestry Street.
Schoolhouse Electric is located at Pacific Hardware and Steel Company Warehouse in Northwest. How did you come to inhabit such a beautiful building? It's spectacular.
Thank you. You know, I was living in Astoria at the time, commuting back and forth, and so I was going along Highway 30, and we were located in the Central East Side, and I kept looking over at the building. It was for sale, and, you know, month after month after month, I would look over at this beautiful brick building and think, should I look at it? And I finally decided, after not being able to find something in the Central East Side, to take a look, and it was love at first sight.
Tell our listeners about Schoolhouse Electric. What is it?
It's a lighting and a housewares company. And we have other makers in the building as well, like Egg Press and Reed LaPlante, Ristretto Roasters, and Flowers by Anamara. So it's a wonderful community of people that are working together.
Well, I was curious about that. So first, let's just tell people where the shop is so if they want to go by there and check it out.
It's 21st and Northwest Nicolai.
It's in Northwest. Are products being manufactured in the building?
You better believe it, yeah. So we manufacture our lighting in that building. And then Egg Press does all their letterpress craft in that building. Reed LaPlante makes all the wood casework there. There's a lot of manufacturing happening there.
Are all of Schoolhouse Electric's products manufactured in that building, or is manufacturing distributed to other locations?
You know, it's all over the United States, but we have a lot of vendors here in Portland besides the manufacturing that we do. So our glass is hand-blown in West Virginia. A lot of our brass spun parts come from Los Angeles. But like I said, we have a lot of vendors right here in Portland, Oregon, which are fantastic.
People are always under the impression, myself included, that manufactured locally in the U.S. is naturally going to cost more because, you know, it's not made by an indentured worker in a gigantic factory who's being paid pennies. How does that work?
You know, I mean, it's interesting because the labor costs are higher here. And you know, there's a lot of people that look at our company and say, like, you know, how do you do it? Like, why aren't you having your product sourced in China or Indonesia or whatnot? But for us, it's our glass is made by union glass blowers. And it's a craft that has been leaving the United States or just basically disappearing. And so the way that they make what glass that appears like ours in China is it's clear glass. It's just painted white. I mean, our glass is a real opal, you know, school glass style glass. And the other thing is that, you know, we are a direct to consumer or business company. And so there's not all these different margins that are being passed along.
Little slices of the pie.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, people are dealing directly with us. And so we're able to be competitive that way.
Well, I'm interested, too, about the relationship that Schoolhouse Electric has with small micro businesses. Mm-hmm. How do... I don't know whether to call them artisans or small or craftspeople. How do they find you, or do you find them? Do you go out looking? Do you think, hey, let's see if there's somebody who makes this widget, and then you go looking for it? How do you find these people, or how do they find you?
You know, it's both. So some people find us, and we find other people, and it can be from going to a fair to online. You know, we might hear that somebody makes something interesting to us on a blog. and then we'll see what other capabilities they have, like what other things can they make besides maybe that product that we were introduced to them by. And so it's really a little bit of both. And some of our vendors are growing along with us well, and others are more challenged by the growth. And so it's been really interesting to see sort of how can, you know, local manufacturing be, you know, sustainable and grow in sort of this world marketplace, consumer marketplace that we're in, where there's so much consumables from overseas. So it's, I think a lot of it is driven actually by the customers that are out there. I mean, I think that the customers that we have at Schoolhouse want something more. They want less, actually. But in getting less, I think they're getting more.
They want more or less now?
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like serendipity is actually part of your business model.
It is.
Is what you're doing super unusual out there in the marketplace, or is there a trend locally manufactured higher quality products? Is that something that you see that people are shifting to, or is it like a division between, you know, the Walmarts versus people who are willing to make kind of conscious shopping decisions?
I mean, I think it's both, really. I mean, I think that there's certainly a movement out there right now. It's untitled, but I think it has a lot to do with a response to this consumer culture that we live in here, you know. And I think that a lot of us have watched our parents or those around us, you know, maybe the baby boomers that have just been, you know, buying and buying and buying. And now look at Portland is unique when you look at sort of the, you know, the city and the retail environment that we have here. When you look at other cities and it's all these, you know, malls after malls after malls.
And really pretty homogenous.
Right, exactly. And that's most of America now, with the exception, in our view, of sort of these urban areas, which where our customers are. You know, our customers are primarily on the East Coast or on the West Coast, and they're in urban areas. And they, for us, that's kind of everything. You know, the sun rises and sets, and those products that are durable and high quality and useful, they're also beautiful.
What do you think it is about vintage design that makes some of us feel warm and fuzzy? Is it that that we're imagining days to have been simpler and less complex to live in?
I think so. I mean, I think there's just something that it can be maybe just a reminder. It can harken back to something that we might remember as a kid, or that we, you know, like a clock, for example. I mean, who really needs a clock? I mean, we all have phones and we can, you know, we can see what time it is. Like, it's connected to our bodies now. Yet when you look up at an old vintage style clock, or one of the clocks that we actually reproduce, like the IBM clock, there's something beautiful about that exchange, you know, and sort of that acknowledgement of, that's just one example. But I think that's an inherent need that we all have, to have this connection with our past or with something that we feel connected to.
Take us through the manufacturing process of creating the handmade glass fixtures.
It's both the glass is one part of the fixture, is also the brass part. The part that we work on a lot is the brass part that comes from at Los Angeles. So it's a hand spun brass that, when it comes in, it has to go through a lot of processes to get to the right finish. The glass that's in West Virginia, you know, to go out there to see these kilns and how many people it takes on a blow line to actually, you know, do this process. I mean, it's. You know, glassware, think about the gas lamps back in the 1700s in America. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. They still make it that same way. So it's, you know, it's a little bit dangerous, but these are highly skilled workers. And yet they're, you know, pulling glass out of a kiln. You know, there's a person that's down below that's holding a mold open while they put the glass inside, and they start blowing on it so the glass expands into this mold to make this shape. Then they spin it, and then they put a little bit of compressed air on it and blow some more. Then they pull it off, and it's, you know, they're turning it and they're handing it to somebody else. And then they're, you know, putting it into an annealer so it hardens. I mean, it's to see it is it's spectacular. I mean, it's just like if you've seen, you know, anything on television about glass blowing. I mean, it's quite amazing.
And it's thick glass. It's not, you know, thin like a glass that you drink out of.
I've heard stories of a shade falling off of a fixture and not breaking. Now, I know that it probably 8 out of 10 times it would break, but I mean, it is pretty thick. Yeah.
It is.
It's real American blown glass. It's a real thing.
How do you stock an entire factory full of qualified glass-blowing, turning, twisting, annealing people?
Well, these people are out in West Virginia, so we actually just get the glass from there. So they're actually a vendor we work with in West Virginia. So we're not actually blowing the glass in Portland.
Yet.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we've looked into that, but it's...
Do these people start as apprentices and then, you know, were they hobbyists who then said, I love this. I want to find somewhere where I can do this and then, you know, get their chops and, you know...
It is very intriguing. I hope they can continue to find people that want to do that craft. So again, it's union labor. So I think that they're well taken care of. I think that there's a good wage that comes along with what they do, but it's also production. This is a production sort of manufacturing process. You know, they're putting out the numbers and, yet, you know, it's one by one. So it's not like a machine process. It's, hand done. So
would you classify yourself as like more of a fix-it person or more of an idea person?
More of an idea person, yeah. Yep.
Tools, wrenches, hammers, so much?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, same here. So what role did psychedelics play in helping you make the leap from realtor to handmade glass lampshade magnet?
Well, you know... I did go to a few, Grateful Dead shows back in the day, so there may be some influence there. But when I was a real estate broker in Portland, I mean, that gave me the chance to go into old homes, you know, and sort of see some that hadn't been touched very much, and so I could really see because there are properties that I've been in that both residential and commercial that are these old beautiful boutiques or residences and. I'm fascinated by sort of how they're put together and, the architecture and the design and the construction and sort of the room configurations and just the environments in the space. And so...
You have an aesthetic.
Yeah, right. I have to say, I mean, I've really studied that, you know, but it, not in a it's something that's a part of me. It's like I'm fascinated with sort of how people live, you know.
They're doodads.
Right.
Yeah, I know. How did you make the decision? What idea came into your mind that, hey, I'm going to stop doing real estate and I'm going to start doing this? And maybe you didn't know it was going to be lampshades right away. Maybe you thought, what could I do? I don't know. How did you transition?
Well, you know, I really love utilitarian fixtures. And so when I was selling these homes, I was working with people that were rehabbing homes, which was kind of the new do-it-yourself movement of the early 90s.
Flipping.
People were buying and flipping houses. I worked with a lot of the people that were doing that. So I was watching what sort of buying habits they had and, you know, what sort of products they were using. And what I saw was that there was really sort of an opening in the marketplace for more utilitarian fixtures. And so... while there are a couple companies that were doing okay with that, I really felt like there was, you know, what had happened to all this old schoolhouse glass? You know, what had happened to all these utilitarian fixtures? I first tried to buy Hippo Hardware right up the street from here, which is kind of crazy because, when you walk into Hippo Hardware, it's like, you know, it looks like a bomb went off or something, but it's a wonderful place and I love it, you know. But that didn't work out. And I'm actually, I'm fortunate that it didn't work out because I think that what was born was sort of this, this company that was founded under the right principle, which was, this heritage glass. And, that's how it all started. It was a difficult transition, but it was something that I was really passionate about. You know, I didn't have a business plan. I think had I done a business plan, I probably wouldn't have ever started the business because it would have told me that I was going to have to go through what I went through for so many years. You know, with little return. But it really wasn't about that, you know. So, and, you know, it's been the work of many as well. So I've had a lot of good, talented people with me along the way that have made a big difference.
I'm Robbie Gaiman with The Digital Divide. I'm speaking with Brian Faherty, founder, owner, and creative director at Schoolhouse Electric, manufacturer and supplier of handmade glass shades made in the United States. I heard you speak at TEDx. That's how you came to be here today, met you there. And your talk was about the balance between your analog and your digital life. And almost all of us are experiencing that. Not everybody, but most of us do experience that. And the digital part is like a big sucking vortex. You know, it's endless. Mm-hmm. It seems to be infinite, and it wants your attention all the time. So could you speak a little bit more to that? Like, why did you pick that for your talk? What was behind that?
I mean, when they emailed me about talking at TEDx, I mean, it was, you know, because it's the thing that I'm struggling the most with. And so I think I really needed sort of to lay out a cathartic experience for myself that I could really, you know, dig deep and deep around, like, how am I dealing with this issue right now and what's going on inside? From what I'm seeing around me with, you know, with my family, my kids, and just my own life, like, how is this affecting me? Because, you know, you and I both, I mean, we weren't born of this generation, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, we had, you know, dial-up phones and, you know what I mean, right? I mean, it was before cable television and, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, my first computer was a Commodore 64, and I would spend all weekend trying to log on with my 300 baud modem into some guy's extra bedroom so I could play Hangman. And that sounds really crazy when I say that today.
You know, so it was something that I was struggling with, and it's something that I really wanted to talk about. And I knew that it wasn't some earth-shattering topic, but it was personal to me, and I felt like, I felt like it was something that was worth talking about.
Well, we're all struggling with that. You know, well, maybe not everybody's struggling with that. You know, maybe people are trying to cram more and more communication, really. It's all about communication,
right,
into each day through, you know, every means. And of course, we've seen, you know, mocking videos, maybe in Portlandia, of people that are just connected with, you know, 5 phones and 3 computers and every kind of social network. And it's consuming them completely. And they're spending every waking minute doing that. And if you look at Facebook, which I know you don't really do, mm-hmm. But that's real.
Yeah, it is. it's definitely real. And I mean, I know that there are people that really that subscribe to it, and that
if you have an addictive, if you have a predisposition towards addictive personalities, then it is tailor made for you.
Oh, it's perfect. Yeah, exactly.
It's so perfect.
It just it seems like it's set up to make our lives more convenient in some way. But the thing that I've been finding are those inconvenient things are really more worthwhile.
So it's all about time,
right?
It's about time and structuring it or allocating it, which is conscious.
Mm-hmm.
The demands on us can force it into being a conscious, like, I'm not going to look at email during this period,
right,
or I'm not going on Facebook for the next 2 hours. I'm closing that tab.
Right. Smartphones are so set up to be our, you know, our calendars are on there, the alarm's on there, all these other things. It's sort of like it's hard to get away from it.
It's my oracle.
It is.
It knows everything about me, and I like it.
That's right.
Those that know me know that.
And it's definitely love-hate, right? I mean, there's things about it that
I love. No, there's no hate. There's all love.
It's all love for you. Yeah.
It's love, but it's like one of those relationships where you have to define boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, there's no hate for me in it, but there have to be boundaries. Otherwise, it's consuming.
Well, for me, it's starting to make me feel like I'm a computer. It's forcing me to pretend sometimes like my brain works like my smartphone, and it doesn't. I mean, I'm not programmed that way. So that's what I hate about it, is that I'm actually an analog person. You know, I mean, I'm a hunter and gatherer. And so I need to spend part of my life doing that stuff and away from that, and I'm trying to find ways to do it, and it's not easy to do.
No, it is challenging. So can you share with us some of the I don't know, what are they? Do you have devices that you make up for yourself, or rules? How do you manage it?
Well, the thing, and I spoke about this a little bit in the TED Talk, was, I mean, I created a space in my building that I can go. That's a digital free room, essentially. And the room, it's called the fire and water room. It's a basic elements. You know, and I have a wood stove, and I go in. I go in there to, you know, either think creatively or to have meetings with people. And where there's no, you can't, you know, phones are off in that room. So it's like there's no iPads, there's no smartphones, and it's just conversation. And that started to kind of wake me up to how important it was to sort of not have the interruptions of, you know, those devices all the time. And if I can get an hour or two in, you know, every day or every other day of uninterrupted conversation with people, it's really started to change my life. I know it sounds crazy, but it really has.
It doesn't sound crazy. It sounds like a really small amount of time
it
to
is.
Not be interrupted.
It is. But I mean, think about, you know, when I don't know about you, but when I wake up, you know, I look over, I turn my alarm clock,
iPad.
On. Yeah. And then it's like, who's emailed me in the middle of the night? It's like, do I really need to do that? But I do. And a lot of it's junk too. So it's like, you know, my brain has to like process so much junk as well. That's the other part that I hate about it. It's like, I don't look at like junk mail, like physical mail. I don't know. It's been interesting, you know, trying to adapt to this new world that we live in now. And also, like, I just started Instagramming probably 3 weeks ago, and so does my 10-year-old daughter and my 11-year-old son. And so here I am, 49, started Instagram, and they're Instagram at the same time. And they have, like, I think each of them have, like, 60 more followers than I do already. And some of my followers are, like, my 10-year-old daughter's, like, friends. You know, it's just hilarious.
That is the new world order, people. How much of a role does following your intuition play in your decision-making in your business?
Everything, I would say, you know, because it's, I think that, you know, I'm a privately owned business. So it's like, you know, my wife and I own the company. And so there's nobody who's telling me, you know, what I need to do or what sort of, you know, formula I need to be following. It's really, you know, kind of my intuition around like what I'm seeing around me. And so it's, you know, I think that some people work that way and some don't. And for me, it's been really good. But it's like, you know, even getting back to that digital thing, you know, for a second, the analog versus digital, it's like the more I can sort of find myself in this analog place, I think I'm more in tune with my intuition. And so that's part of the reason I think that I wanted to talk about it. And part of the reason I've been struggling with it so much is that, that's the part of me that I think is the more authentic side. And so I need to stay plugged into that. And if that gets unplugged, I don't know where I'm going to take this company. So,
yeah, that's a really good point. When we're connecting and communicating through digital means, we don't really have the quiet to hear our own voice,
right,
or to allow those ideas to kind of emerge organically, those thoughts, those crazy ideas, domain names, whatever.
Right.
You know, in the quiet when you're not communicating. But, you know, one of the things that really intrigues me about this new world, and I am also pre-internet, something unprecedented is occurring, mm-hmm, and that around communication. And so I feel really confident saying that today, even more than yesterday, and more than any time in history, more people, men and women, because communication in the old world, mm-hmm, was really in the domain of women. Women were the communicators, and men just used telephones for business. They didn't really use them socially,
right,
in the traditional good old days,
mm-hmm,
good old bad days, whatever we want to call them. And now we have everybody is communicating,
mm-hmm,
constantly. And it intrigues me because I wonder, will it be like a 100th monkeys thing? Will there be a crack? Will there be a breakthrough? What will all of this unprecedented communication with each other, whether it's mundane or banal or exciting or profound, doesn't, mm-hmm, matter. People are expressing themselves,
mm-hmm,
through words and images. What's going to happen? What does that mean? Is that part of our human evolution? Because presumably, this isn't always true, but, mm-hmm, presumably, the more language we use, the more civilized we would become.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Man, I don't know. That's pretty rhetorical. You know, it's you know, in my TED talk, I brought up the 1984 ad, you know, which was that Apple ad that was one of the most, you know, it was shown one time.
The Think Different?
Yeah, the Think Different ad, you know, where the woman's running through the drones and she throws the sledgehammer and breaks the screen and, mm-hmm, all those drones are watching it. And it was introducing the new Macintosh computer at the,
right,
time.
Drones equal Microsoft in this commercial.
Exactly. But, you know, I look at that and I say, but like, where is Apple now in this equation? So Apple was trying to find their way into this IBM-dominated marketplace or Microsoft, you know, dominated marketplace. And now Apple's sort of, I'm not, you know, if they're not Big Brother, if they are, they're pretty damn cool, Big Brother. But I don't know where it's going. That's kind of what sort of scares me a little bit.
But surely this level of communication just between humans.
Yeah.
My brain says it has to be a good thing.
Yeah.
But I'm not convinced.
Yeah, me too. Exactly. I think I have mixed emotions about it, you know. And so it's I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see kind of where this goes right now. There are parts of, I'm a real visual person, so I love, like Instagram, I love because I get to see what other people are looking at, you know, these images of something that they captured their day. Like they might have stumbled across a flower or an old sign on a brick building or something, and they're sharing that. And I love that part.
Oh, now I'm going to have to start Instagramming too.
It's really...
I can hardly stop looking at Pinterest.
Yeah. But, and so I guess, and you kind of nailed it earlier. It's like, it's finding that sort of some balance between, you know, being a human being and then being stimulated and communicating with people, you know, because it can really help, I guess, get the creative juices going, you know, some of the things that are digital, but at the same time, so kind of walk in the park, you know, and so we can't kind of confuse one for the other. It's like, I can't like look at a picture of a park and have it be the same experience as walking in the park, you know, and so I have to remember.
Can that in Vegas.
In Vegas you can, right. Anything's possible there.
I can't thank you enough for coming by and talking with us today. Thank you so much for joining us and our listeners on the Digital Divide. Thanks for making local really local.
And thanks for what you do too. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to visit with you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and be sure and tune in every second Friday of the month at 11 a.m. for more Digital Divide. Coming up next, Don Jacobson and Moving On.
La Contessa, she has a laugh of secret. She has a laugh of greater wealth and a greater poverty. She has many loves. She break her hearts. She has a heart to break. She fed a duel with a man. She live on the edge of survival when she was in a resistance and a king have a price on her head. She look down at you, soul, and it give you just what you need.
Tune in to The Confessional with 2 solid hours of conscience-cleansing radio. Sundays at midnight, only on KBOO FM Portland.
This is Judy Collins, and wishing KBOO Radio a happy 45th anniversary.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson. And in just a few minutes, it'll be time for moving on. Right now, we have the news headlines.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, June 13th. I'm Kristen Yount. Business as usual in Greece ground to a halt today as people began protesting the Greek government's closure of the public broadcaster, the Hellenic Broadcasting Corporation, or ERT. In response to the silencing today, massive strikes have rocked the country. Train operators, broadcast journalists, and government offices were shut down earlier today. Air traffic controllers and hospital workers are expected to participate on a limited basis. The last nationwide strike occurred last February. The oldest broadcast media and outfit, the ERT, reported during World War II and has been operating for 75 years. This morning, the Supreme Court ruled that DNA from living organisms that are discovered by genetics labs